This is How Success Happens, where the staff of Entrepreneur chats with innovators, writers, artists, chefs, and a range of other unique personalities to better understand the traits that make excellence possible.
Nobody in Silicon Valley thinks it's actually them. They think everybody else is like this.
One of my regrets actually now, we should have pulled the plug sooner.
It's amazing when the universe sees you commit, how all of a sudden all these resources start to come together.
Thanks for joining us. And now, How Success Happens.
Eight-hour workdays, no pointless meetings, vacations that are actually vacations. It all sounds great, but how do you make it happen? I'm Liz Weber, Insights Editor at Entrepreneur.com, and today I'm talking to Basecamp co-founder and CEO Jason Fried about his new book, It Doesn't Have to Be Crazy at Work, co-written with Basecamp co-founder David Heinmeier Hansen, and how to apply a non-crazy culture to your company. But first, a word from our sponsors.
FedEx delivers millions of packages around the world, but for FedEx, it's not just about packages or pallets, it's about what those deliveries mean for people. Whether it's rekindling a long-lost connection between old friends, a new business opportunity, or providing much-needed hope after a natural disaster in the form of relief supplies, FedEx delivers more than just packages. FedEx delivers possibilities. Find out more at fedex.com/possibilities.
And now for our second sponsor. This episode is brought to you by Jamf Now. Jamf Now makes it easy to set up, manage, and protect your Apple devices. It's easy to keep track of your own Mac, iPad, or iPhone. But what about the other Apple devices at work? As a business grows, so does its digital inventory, making it harder to manage everyone's Apple devices. This is especially true if employees are remote. With Jamf Now, you can check your digital inventory, distribute Wi-Fi and email settings, deploy apps, protect company data, and even lock or wipe a device as needed, from anywhere. Jamf Now manages devices so you can focus on your business instead. No IT experience needed. How Success Happens, listeners. Start securing your business today, setting up your first three devices for free, forever. Add more starting at just $2 a month per device. Create your free account today at jamf.com/HSH. That's jamf.com/HSH. Well, thanks for joining me today, Jason.
Thanks for having me on.
So I wanted to get right into the book. What you talk about in the book all makes total sense to me. It's all very common sense. Sounds great, you know, no working on vacation and don't disrupt people during the day. And then you'll have these 8-hour days, 40-hour weeks. Sounds really awesome. However, actually getting to that place, especially if you have bad habits already ingrained into your company or as a startup, you've got VCs who are wanting to see results from you, that's hard. It's hard to do. So where can you start?
It is hard. Breaking any habit's really hard, which is why this stuff's so important. As far as where to start, there's two places. One place to start is if you're starting a brand new company, like literally starting tomorrow, building some of these good habits now, because they become much, much, much harder to break later.
Of course.
But let's say you're reading this book now and you're like 3 years in or 5 years in or whatever, and someone's breathing down your neck and your hair's on fire and the whole thing, like what do you do? I'd say, first of all, you got to start really, really small. So you got to pick one thing that you just don't like. Like maybe, or that, you know, if you own the place, it's maybe you don't like, maybe you're fine with it, but you can tell other people have been talking to you about it. Maybe like your benefits aren't good, or people feel like they don't have any time to do any work at the office, so they're working on the weekends. Like, well, why is that? You have to start digging into these things and figuring out what's going wrong. So there's probably one thing that you should start with. My thing would probably be, making sure people at least have an additional hour a day to themselves to do more work. So I'd like to see 8-hour days, 40-hour weeks, but let's say you can't get there immediately for whatever reason. How can you give someone an extra hour in the day to themselves? Not like tacking on an extra hour, but actually eliminating something that the company is doing and taking their time away, or if there are distractions at the office that are pulling people away from their work. So work on figuring out how people can get an hour back to themselves. Start there. I think people are gonna appreciate that. They're gonna go, okay, this is better now. I have more time to myself. I can get more stuff done. I'm working less on the weekends and less at night because I'm doing work at the office like I'm supposed to. Then you can kind of branch off from there. So I think small victories, little bit of wins, get some momentum going, and then kind of, you know, go through the rest of the book and hopefully adopt some more of these things.
Sure. And so one of the other ways that you can kind of cut back on the amount of total time that you're working is to just decide not to do things. And that's not, you know, for our work week, delegate everything away. That's actually making a conscious decision to say, we don't need to do this anymore, or this isn't as important, so we should not do this. But again, that's a really hard thing to decide. What are you going to just stop doing, or, you know, not start doing ever? I mean, where do you start on that kind of process?
By the way, all the stuff is hard. And it's harder the longer you've been doing it the other way.
Right.
So actually, in some ways, it's not hard at the beginning.
Right.
Then it just gets hard, right? Mm-hmm. Like anything, any bad habit we pick up. You know, for this one, I would look at what do you do that you don't even consider anymore? For example, like, let's say you always have a Monday morning stand-up meeting. Mm-hmm. And you've just been doing it for 5 years, like, because that's what you do.
Right.
Every Monday, you know, 50 weeks a year, whatever, you do this stand-up meeting. It's like, why are we doing that? So I would look at these things that you just take for granted, that just have to be done, that you've always done, that are repetitive or rote or something, and say,
sure,
you know what, let's just not do this next week. Let's just take this next Monday, let's just not do this, and let's see what happens. And you'll probably find that, like, the you know, the world doesn't come crashing down and the business doesn't stop.
Right.
And you're like, this actually wasn't so bad. And maybe we need to figure, maybe there's some information that wasn't shared that we need to figure out a different way to share.
Right.
But now, like, people have an extra hour of their day back. Mm-hmm. And we can maybe write it up instead and send it out versus getting everyone in a room to talk about it in real time. So I think the thing I would look at are things that have become sort of repetitive and habit-based that you just don't even consider. And look at those and go, let's just not do that again. Because I think when you, the moment you begin, or you, I should say, you stop thinking about something that you're doing, is a good time to bring thought back into it. You go, well, why are we even doing this? Because there's lots of things we used to do, you know, that we just, you kind of get used to these things and you just do them. And you're like, why are we doing this at some point? Like, why are we doing this? Why do we have this policy? Or why do we have this thing that we do? And you kind of start breaking that down and you realize that everything's going to be just fine without it. So I think that's a really good thing to run into.
Definitely. I think going back to the first question a little, starting with one thing or one small thing, like you said, the Monday morning meeting, that's like an easy thing to say, to put those questions rather than the big things that take up your time.
Yeah, I think that's like, so we're a very meeting-averse company at Basecamp. We basically don't have meetings. And I would define as a meeting as three or more people in a room together. So like there's occasional two people get together in a room to talk about something. But so we're pretty meeting averse to begin with, but I know most companies are not. And a lot of companies have like a weekly stand up or a weekly something or all hands or staff meeting or something like that.
Yes.
And I would bet you that almost all the information that's actually transferred in that particular meeting does not have to be spoken about in real time. Like you don't have to pull everyone away from their desk to tell them something right now that has nothing to do with right now. Most of this information is about later.
Yes.
So you could write it up instead. And think about like doing more of like an internal newsletter style thing where every Monday morning someone's tasked with writing up. Like over the week you could submit like status updates or whatever you share at these meetings.
Okay.
And then it's just sort of disseminated across the company via whatever system, email or Basecamp or whatever system you're using, doesn't matter. And it's sent out to everybody. And they read it on their own time. Unless there's something urgent, truly urgent, because a lot of people think everything's urgent, but like truly urgent that needs to be talked about at 9 a.m. on Monday morning, don't talk about it. Instead, write it up. So that's right. Sort of one place you can begin to change behavior.
Definitely. And one other thing that stuck out to me in the book, you actually advocate for compromising on quality. So figuring out where you don't have to put 100% of your effort so that you can spend more of your time doing more things. And coming from entrepreneur, it reminds me a little bit of the idea of the minimum viable product, where you're just getting it to a place where it's good enough and then you send it out into the world. Not quite the same as what you're saying, but similar. But again, how do you decide when something is good enough?
Yeah. The fundamental idea there, of course, is that you should not bring like your absolute A game, whatever, to everything. That's just
right.
Silly. But a lot of people think they have to, for a reason. So minimum viable product is a very good framework for that. to think about it. The way we look at it is, when you're building something, whatever you're building, you need to really, really understand the domain. Like, what are you actually making and why are you making it? When you understand that, the rest of it becomes a lot easier. When you don't know what you're building, like if you're just building something randomly or you're building something for the client that you don't understand, it's hard to know when enough is enough because you're just building to like a spec.
Sure.
Or you're building to a list of things it needs to do. But when you really understand the thing that you're making, so this is what I would suggest, is you have to get to understand the thing that you're making and really understand why you're making it, what it's for, what it's supposed to do, what it really needs to absolutely do.
Okay.
When you get to that level of depth on something, you begin to really see what matters and what doesn't. So I'll give you a quick example. When we built Basecamp originally, back in 2004, the first version of it, we built it for ourselves. And we knew what we needed because we were managing projects by sending emails around or phone calls or having in-person meetings. And we knew like that was very inefficient. We were missing things. Things were slipping through the cracks. We couldn't figure stuff out. There wasn't a central source where all feedback was stored for everyone to see it. So like we had these very clear problems that we needed to solve. And we knew exactly what would solve those problems. We can keep asking ourselves when we're building this thing, like, has that problem gone away? If it's gone away, it's good enough. If it hasn't yet gone away, then it's probably not good enough. And you kind of keep going till it goes away. So once it goes away, it's good enough. Then you can ask yourself, like, it's gone away. Do we want to polish this up a bit more to make it a little bit better? Or is it actually adequate? And that's more of a judgment call, like a values thing at that point. Mm-hmm. But when the problem goes away is when you should stop. And then you ask yourself, do we need to put anything else into this or are we good? So I think, we're fortunate that we build things for ourselves first, and then we sell things to customers. So every product we make, we build for ourselves. So it makes it a lot easier for us to know where the lines are. But if you can't do that, then you really got to get to understand what it is that you're building, and then these things come into focus. Otherwise, if you don't know what you're building, like for example, if I was building a system for healthcare something, like I wouldn't, and I'm not using it every day, I wouldn't really know what it needs to do. I'd be taking someone else's word for it. When you take someone else's word for it, it's very hard to define or to discern how much value there is in this thing that it needs to do. I'm making air quotes here, that it needs to do, or like it should do, or kind of has to do. It's hard to tell. So you kind of just end up going all out because you have no other choice. You don't want to undershoot. You end up overshooting on everything that you don't understand. So you kind of cover a lot of ground. So
right.
Anyway, I'm rambling a bit there, but getting to know what you're doing is the most important part of it.
Definitely. I think that's why so many entrepreneurs who found businesses based on a problem that they have end up being so successful because they're so intimately aware of what that problem is and what needs to be done to fix it.
Totally agree. I don't invest, I'm not an investor, but if I was an investor, I would invest in people who are solving their own problems versus someone who has a vision to solve some problem they don't really understand, but it's a big market.
Right.
I don't care about, like, that's hard, really, really hard to do. But at least if you have your own problem to solve, you're motivated, first of all, to solve your own problem. You really understand it really well. And there's probably a good chance a lot of other people have a similar problem. Mm-hmm. I think that's a really good place to be.
So Basecamp obviously is a tech company. And I felt like reading the book, obviously the examples are very specific to your experience as a tech company. But what if you're not a tech company? Like, how do you try to apply these same principles to a media company or an airline or a luggage company, whatever?
Yeah. I mean, some businesses, of course, are under slightly different time pressures. Like, for example, in the media business, if you're in the newspaper business or even magazine business, there can be breaking news and, like, you know, something super important breaks at 2 a.m, like, okay. You got to deal with that, right? But most companies aren't in the media business, and most companies aren't airlines, and most companies aren't like extremely mission critical, cannot fail, like kind of. Most companies are pretty run of the mill, boring companies like ours. We make a product we care about. We have a lot of customers, over 100,000 people pay to use Basecamp on a monthly basis. Big, great business, although we're a small business, but like a lot of influence, a lot of customers. But really, it's like a, you know, there's no crisis. There's no like immediate breaking news. There's nothing we need to absolutely do by tomorrow at 9 a.m. So I think most companies are like that. I think a lot of companies create false urgency and create a false sense of importance. And,
sure.
Like, we are so important. We must be, you know, on call 24/7. Like, we have some people that are on call 24/7 in terms of not individuals, but we have shifts that go full 24/7 because we have customer service all the time. We have operations and servers need to stay up and stuff like that. But those people only work 8-hour shifts too. So you can have a lot of coverage, and you can have a lot of immediacy when you need to, but you can't have someone, I don't believe, working 12, 14 hours and think that they're going to be sharp. They're going to be tired and burned out. So you have to make sure that you have a workforce that's split and fresh. But I think in general, people are people and companies are companies. And, you know, it doesn't matter what industry you're in. You burn out, you're burned out. You're tired, you can't make good decisions. If you lack sleep, you're going to be difficult to work with. If you're a manager and you're sleep deprived, like, people are below you are going to have a hard time with you, and you're going to have a hard time with them. Everything blows up into a big deal really quickly. So it doesn't matter if you work at a dry cleaner, or you work at a tech industry, or you work at a restaurant, whatever. We've all seen what it's like when people are you know, fraying at the edges. So I don't think these are really. We use the example like in the book. We're sharing our examples, and we do happen to be a software company, but
right. They're
human issues. They're not so much about the technology at all. We could be making Frisbees, I think, and it'd be the same sort of thing. Like, I could push people to work 14 hours at a Frisbee factory, or I could say, let's work 8 hours and be reasonable and make fewer mistakes, that sort of thing.
Right.
Yeah.
It's about the quality of the time that you're putting in rather than the amount of time.
And that 8 hours is a lot of time.
Right.
This is the thing that I think people forget in these days, which is like an 8 hour day is actually a lot of time. The thing is that it's not a lot of time to yourself if your company is chunking it up into smaller bits. So, for example, I live in Chicago. If I was to fly from Chicago to London, it's about an 8 hour flight.
Mm-hmm.
And I guarantee you, halfway through that flight, I'm looking at my watch, hoping it's over. It's like, oh my God, there's still 4 hours to go. Like, this is a long time.
Right.
But in a work day, you look at your watch and it's 4:30 already, and you're like, oh my God, where'd all the time go? It's the same amount of time. In one case, you can't wait for it to like be over. The flight is long, and you have nothing to do. In other cases, you're like, I didn't do anything today, even though I was busy all day. Same amount of time. So 8 hours is plenty of time to do great work if you actually have the time to do the work. That's the difference. Companies that let their employees do the work and not, you know, strand them in meetings all day or have a culture of interruption or immediate response will end up having, like, people will be fulfilled by the end of the day and feel like I'm ready to go home and they did all their work and there's a lot of work that got done and it'll be fine. So 8 hours a day, 40 hours a week is plenty of time to do great work if people have that time to themselves.
Definitely.
In any industry.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
I can definitely agree with that.
Yeah. And I know, like, for example, if you're, you know, some doctors or medical residents are like 24-hour shifts, like, that's a different world.
Sure.
And, you know, frankly, I think that's dangerous.
Right.
You know, like, people are sleep deprived in medicine is a really dangerous thing.
Right.
But most industries are not that way.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
All makes sense.
Yeah.
Hopefully. I know one of the things that you've mentioned and comes up a lot in the book is the thing that interrupts a lot of people's days is meetings and bringing people together to discuss things that don't need to be discussed in person, that don't need 10 people in a room, could be, maybe have three. And so one thing that I thought was interesting that you do at Basecamp is rather than have a meeting when someone has an idea they want to present, they have to come up with a proposal. And that reminded me, Jeff Bezos is famous for at Amazon, I think they still have the meeting, but first you have to write up a 6-page memo that describes like what it is that you're gonna present.
Yeah.
And then another idea that is similar at Basecamp that you started first, but then came up with a name for it after hearing that Jeff Bezos calls it commit and disagree, which was you don't have to have complete unanimous consensus on something. You can say, I understand where you're coming from. I don't think this is the right way to do it, but enough of you have said that we should try it, so I commit,
right. But
I disagree. And then we'll see what happens. Both of those things, not necessarily that you've borrowed directly from Amazon, they have similarities, but just wondering if there are other aspects of Basecamp's culture that are similar to other places, were inspired by other companies that you have taken from seeing good things that work elsewhere?
Sure. I mean, we're inspired by a lot of different companies of all scales. So, by the way, one of the things I like about the Amazon folklore, I've never worked there, don't know if it's true, but I think it probably is, about how they write these extensive things first, is I believe they have to, when they go to the meeting, they read them either out loud or they take 15 minutes to read.
I think everyone reads in silence.
Okay, that's what it is. And so it's cool because most people are never prepared for a meeting because, like, when do they have time to do that? So people go to the meeting and they're like, has everyone read the thing? Everyone's like, yeah, I read the thing. And no one like actually,
no one
read,
actually
the
read the thing.
Right. So I love that they actually just recognize that that's human nature. So let's just cut out time or carve aside or carve out time for people to actually read this thing. I just think that that's really, it's a really, people talk about human-centric stuff and whatever, but like that's just acknowledging human nature and the realities of things. And I love that approach. Anyway, one of the things that inspired us was a book written quite a while ago, maybe it's like maybe 15 years old now or something, called Maverick by a guy named Ricardo Semler.
Okay.
And he's a Brazilian guy who runs a business called Semco. I don't know if he still does, but he may have. It was his father's business. It was handed down to him, huge industrial business. I think they make like oil pumps for like huge oil tankers, like really big, complicated machines, and maybe just one of them, you know, really custom okay. stuff. And I think his dad died, or I forget the story, but this guy, Ricardo, gets the business. And there's like a few thousand people working there, I think. And he looks around and he goes, I don't understand this place at all. Like there's like a rule book that's like, you know, 5 inches thick. And like, I don't get this. The process doesn't make any sense. Like, why are we doing these things that we're doing? And no one had an answer. So he'd go around like asking managers and groups, like, why do you do it this way? And why do you do it this way? And no one knows. It's just like, this is just the way we do it. So he basically kind of threw it all out and said, like, let's just figure out our way of doing things. Let's question all these things that we're doing and figure out how to simplify this business and give people more power and cut back on the layers of management and cut back on the hierarchy and just give people the power and let them do their work, basically. Now, their business is very different from ours, but
sure.
And it's been wildly successful outcomes from this. And the book is wonderful. And he writes a really wonderful, comfortable, easy-paced book to read. It's a wonderful book. And that inspired David and I, David's my co-founder, to do the same thing with our business, but start from there versus like have a big lumbering business that we didn't understand.
Right.
But we read this sort of in the early days of our business and began to question things. And so that sort of spirit of saying like, we don't have to do it the way it's always been done. We don't have to do it the way everyone else is doing it. We don't have to follow anyone else. We can actually just think about, you know, what's going on and why are we doing this? We can constantly question our business and constantly iterate on improving our business, not just our product. So people talk about, everybody knows how to improve a product. You sort of iterate on it and iterate on it and iterate on it. We do the same thing for our business. We constantly iterate on our business. And I think that spirit came from reading Ricardo Semler's book. But there's other businesses, like I'm inspired by the local dry cleaner and local small grocery store I go to. How simple those businesses are. I love that. Like I go in, I get some peanut butter, it's $4, I buy it. Like
right.
We used to have very complicated pricing at Basecamp. We had like 5 different tiers and different prices depending on how many things you had. And just last year we said, screw all that. Basecamp is $99 a month. No matter how many people you have, no matter how many projects you have, I don't care how big your company is or how small your company is, Basecamp has a price. Just like that jar of peanut butter has a price.
Sure.
And so that inspired us too. Just like the simplicity of pricing everywhere else in the world is pretty straightforward. But you get into software, it's like tiers and users and seats. It's like, why not just simplify all that? So I'm inspired by big, huge companies, small companies, anyone who's doing something novel and interesting that makes sense to me. And simplicity is really a key driver for us too. So anyway, that's the kind of stuff that drives us.
That's great. I like that you take inspiration from the simplest things and you're looking, you know, not just how can we as a tech company do things better, but how can we as a company, as people, figure out what's the best way of doing things?
Yeah, because again, it doesn't matter. I don't think it matters what industry we're in, although our industry is, I think, particularly sick in a bad way, perverse and sick, dry, overwork and all these things. But aside from all that, it's still people doing this stuff. And why make things hard on ourselves? It's kind of one of our mottos, basically. Why make things hard on ourselves?
Right.
And just kind of what's the simplest version of this? What's the least we can do to achieve the most we need? And let's move on from there once we make that work.
Definitely.
Yeah.
So you do mention this a little bit in the book. Sometimes it doesn't work out with a particular person or a particular practice. People are used to doing things a certain way. They're used to being the boss of their little team and being heavily involved. They're used to being able to IM someone and get an instantaneous response. And I imagine that there are certain people who come to Basecamp and that's not the way it works. And it rubs them the wrong way.
Yeah.
Have you ever had that experience and had to part ways with someone who just didn't fit in with the Basecamp culture?
Yeah, we have. The primary problem we have with cultural fit is around remote working. So we are we're pretty much a remote company. We have about 55 people in the company, and we have 14 people who work out of Chicago, our main office.
Okay.
But even those people are only in the office maybe 2 days a week. They all work from home the rest of the week, and then we have about 30 some odd other people, or 40 other people who work in about 30 different cities around the world. US, Canada, Europe, Australia, Hong Kong, South America now as well. And so you have to be used to working remotely or interested in working remotely if you want to work at Basecamp.
Right.
And that's primarily where the cultural challenges come up for some people who've never done it before. Certainly give them a chance. Some people love it. Some people, they crave more human connection in terms of physical connection with seeing people at work all the time, which they don't have when they're working remotely.
Sure.
Even if they go to a co-working space, it's just like, it's not the same as your coworkers, right? So some people aren't good at that or don't like, I shouldn't say aren't good at it. It's that they just simply don't like it.
Right.
Totally fine. So that's where some situations don't work out. Other people find that they love it. So that's been primarily the biggest thing, and it's pretty clear, and they bring it up. Because it's very hard to, you can ask people about it and stuff, but ultimately when somebody leaves who works remotely, someone who leaves typically will say, like, I just missed this, or I just missed that, or, you know, I thought I would love working remotely, but I just didn't love it enough, or I found it really challenging.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the primary thing that we run into. And as we mentioned in the book, whenever somebody leaves, this is really kind of a unique thing about our company. I shouldn't say unique because there's probably others, but not many. We just let when someone leaves, they get to write up a goodbye message to the whole company. It's sent out to everybody, and everybody gets a chance to say goodbye back to them. There's never any secret shoved out the door, get the security kind of thing.
Right.
Or like, what happened to, you know, to Bill? Well, Bill's just not here anymore. Like, we don't talk about Bill anymore. You know, we don't have those situations. So everyone gets to say goodbye to each other, and that's a really nice way to go, even when things just didn't work out.
Definitely.
Yeah.
I think that goes to the culture of transparency, of making sure everyone's on the same page about things. And I feel like that probably is a really healthy way to go about it.
There's really no alternative, in my opinion, because not saying something doesn't mean it's not going to be said.
Right.
Everyone else is going to say it. Like, there's going to be back channel discussions and there's going to be rumors and conjecture, and almost always, like, rumors are almost always worse than reality. So if someone just shoved out the door and you don't hear from them again, like, people start to get nervous. They start to make up reasons why that person's gone. They start to think, am I next? Like, this was a relatively new person. Well, I'm the second newest person. Am I gone next? Like, no one knows. And so they fill in the gaps with their own stories. So if you're not clear about that, like, you're just hurting yourself.
Right.
It's hard to be clear about these things sometimes because there's reasons why people have to be let go, or there's reasons why people leave that are uncomfortable. But, you know, again, if they're not out in the open and they're not clear, then they will be in the shadows and murky. And that's the worst place for that kind of news. So I think being open is the only real way to be, because the alternative is way worse.
So you mentioned that Basecamp is a remote company for the most part. People kind of get to work in their own places. And one of the things you mentioned in the book, work doesn't happen at work, probably because of all of those interruptions that happen. So people find where it is that they want to do their work. Where is it that you do your work?
Luckily, our physical office is set up in a way where it's very quiet. We have this thing called library rules, which runs, basically that's how we run our office. So you walk into any library around the world, and everybody, you would know how to behave. Everybody knows how to behave in a library.
Right.
No matter where they are in whatever culture, quiet, respectful, because people are reading, learning, thinking, whatever, right? Most offices are more designed like a noisy kitchen than a quiet library. Our office is designed like a library. So if you walk in our office, it's very quiet. People are not talking out loud. So I'm actually able to get a lot of work done at the office, but I have a home office too. And I work from home 2 or 3 days a week, and I go in the office a couple days a week. And sometimes it's different kinds of work. Like, I'll go in the office if I want to work with someone on something, or if I need to get a lot of paperwork done, sometimes I go to the office. Because when I'm at home, I tend to be a little bit more creative. And when I'm at the office, it's a little bit more managerial for whatever reason. That's just kind of how my time and my sort of energy's been split, I've noticed. So I kind of follow that pattern. But we're fortunate in that you can get work done at the office at Basecamp.
Sure.
But most people I've talked to, and I've talked to a lot of people, I did a TED talk on this a number of years ago about how work doesn't get done at work anymore. And I interviewed a lot of people about it. And most people say, like, I get work done at the office only if it's really early in the morning or late at night or something like that when everyone's gone. So they're trying to, like, get away from the distractions, or they do it in their car or on the train or on a plane. Like, they find they're really able to work on planes. And I was like, why is it so easy to work on planes? It's because you're not being distracted, you know, essentially. So that's where a lot of people have to go. They have to go away from the office to
sure.
get work done, which is unfortunate. Or on the weekends or something like that, which is just not a really good place for it.
No.
Yeah.
And, I mean, maybe you do get good work done there, but how is that healthy for you?
Totally. Yeah, like, so let's say you do get great work done on Sunday afternoon. Like, okay, like, maybe that's true, but that's broken.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, the fact that you have to do that on a Sunday afternoon means that there's something broken during the weekdays for sure at the company. And if you are in a position of power to change that, you should. If you're not in a position of power to change that, you might want to bring it up with someone who's higher up. And it's hard. I by the way, completely acknowledge that change is very hard, especially when you don't have any power to make the change. Of course. Like, you're not going to be able to read this book if you don't have a lot of power and, like, change your business, right? But
right.
you can probably change your local environment. Maybe a couple, if you work with a couple team members, you can change that. Or you can just change your own behavior. So, for example, if you find yourself constantly interrupting someone, asking them a question all the time, maybe you should just be more mindful of the fact that, gosh, when I'm interrupting somebody all the time to ask them a question, I'm breaking their day up. So maybe I'll just start doing that less. Maybe I'll look for the answers myself next time. And so small little changes like that can start to lead to changed behavior, which other people can pick up on and go, you know what, Jason hasn't been bothering me that much anymore. That's kind of nice. Maybe I won't bother him as much. And then you can kind of slowly, in your local sphere at least, make some changes that other people pick up on and hopefully adopt as well.
Sure. Yeah. Definitely leading by example, if whether you're at the top of the company or just, you know, a cog in the machine, so to speak.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you have to be, what's the Gandhi quote, like, you have to be the change you wish to see in the world.
Right.
And again, I get that, like, you can be changing all day. Like, I get people on Twitter saying, like I'm doing my best and, like, nothing's happening. And I can completely empathize and sympathize with that situation.
Sure.
That's frustrating for sure. But at the very end of the day, like, at least you're doing the right thing for others. And hopefully people will do the right thing for you at some point. Yeah.
Going back to that human connection, that reciprocal behavior, making
yes.
things better as humans.
Yes, yes. Hopefully, and you just hope that that's the case.
Right.
Yeah.
I really liked how you called out in the book the different writers and other creative people and talking about what their habits were, because they're not nose to the grindstone, got to finish this 10,000-page book in a week. Like, for example, Tony Kushner, he writes longhand with a fountain pen, and when he runs out of ink, that's when he's done for the day.
Yeah.
I really like that. So obviously, this is not your first book. You've written several with David.
Yeah.
How do you approach that? What's your writing style?
Yeah. First of all, I love that example. And in one of our other books, Rework, we had an example of a sandwich shop down the street from us that just closes when they run out of bread. Basically, get
nice.
Like, you know, I don't know, 50 loaves of bread a day or 50, like, you know, baguettes or whatever. And when they're out, they're out. And that's when mm-hmm. they close. They don't have hours, essentially. And I'm really driven or drawn, I should say, to those kinds of natural examples of just, like, I'm done when it's naturally done. So I like
right.
that. Anyway, that was an aside. The way we typically work, for example, in this book, the challenge with writing with a partner is that we have different voices.
Sure.
And David's writing is much more, currently is much more sort of poetic and flowery, and mine's more direct and sort of concise. David and I initially attacked this book by trying to split up the essays.
Okay.
Because we have different writing styles, right? And so we found that that was harder to do. When we wrote some other books together, the earlier books, we actually had similar writing style, more similar writing styles, so we could sort of split up, but our writing styles have diverged a bit over
Interesting.
Time. So what we ultimately did with this book is I did the first drafts of most of the essays, probably 90% of the essays.
Okay.
And then David came in and reviewed those and added some flourishes and added some adjustments and rewrote some of them and adjusted back and forth. And so we found that starting with a standard common base, which was my voice,
okay,
and then bringing his voice into it was a much more effective way to actually collaborate on this particular book. I think ultimately it turned out really well because of that. I think the initial take, we actually wrote a bunch and then threw it out and started over because it was too sort of all over the place in terms of style.
Sure.
So I think this worked out well. And if we write another one day, we'll have to see what our style, maybe our styles will come back together, or maybe it'll diverge even more. But I think this sort of worked out well. Typically, we also wrote, like, the book was about 40, I think we handed in 41 or 42,000 words, and I think we edited it down to about 20, somewhere between 26 and 28,000 words.
Okay.
So we really tightened it up a lot.
Sure.
Which is what we want to do, because a lot of the stuff you write is just, it's not junk, but it doesn't need to be said. And like really honing in, we want to make sure there's no filler. And
right.
Part of the reason why is because I almost never finish business books.
Okay.
I get about halfway through and I'm like, okay, that's enough.
Right.
Like it's enough. It's starting to get repetitive or like you can tell that it's just padding in a sense.
Sure.
We want to make sure that people can finish our book in 3 hours or less and that nobody reads half and goes, I've read it all. I'm done. Like mm-hmm. We want people to feel like they can't put it down and then truly be done in 3 hours. So that's why we're really aggressive on editing and making sure the chapters and essays are really, really short and punchy and then moving on.
Well, I can definitely attest that it was an easy read.
And, thank you.
And in a good way.
Yeah. I think it's always a good thing. Like, I don't think hard reads are... I don't see why anything should be a hard read.
Right.
Personally. but anyway, we enjoyed writing it. So anyway, that's how we approached it.
Great. Yeah. It's an interesting approach to collaboration that, you know... starting with you and then having David come in and kind of put in his take as well. And interesting also that you've evolved over time. I think that, you know, business, you also have to do that too, figuring out, well, who's going to take the lead on this and what approach are we going to take and is this approach going to work every time or should we think about maybe there's a different approach for the next project that we work on?
Totally. And actually, you know, I think 50-50 is the worst ratio in business. Like it should never be 50-50.
And it never works out that way anyway.
Right, true. So and by the way, I should just to be totally clear here, in some of the essays, like David just had a stronger point of view. And so he took a couple of those himself and then I came in and did the opposite sort
okay.
of thing. But I think like someone needs to take the lead on this stuff, on anything, and then you basically, you know, you have a partner in it essentially. But not a 50-50 partner, because I just don't think that's a good ratio. You need someone to be leading these things. Anyway, that's how we did it. And I think most of the essays were like, we kind of went over them maybe two or three times and then we figured we were done. So that's kind of how we approached it.
Great.
Yeah.
Well, one last thing that I want to bring up that comes, I think, pretty early on in the book that I think is really important to think about, particularly the culture that's come up around entrepreneurship and constantly hustling and like you gotta win, you gotta get there, you gotta rebound from your failure. So the view that the opposite of conquering the world isn't failure, it's participation. And how do you kind of adapt to that mindset when you're in this cutthroat whatever entrepreneur world?
Yeah, the hustle world. I mean, to me it's just a matter of playing the odds really and probability. Like if you go into something thinking you must dominate it, you're almost certainly going to lose. Because like domination means one winner, essentially. Or even two or three, let's say. But think about how many people are going into something. Like in any business, whatever business you're in, there's thousands of, in some cases, tens of thousands of businesses essentially like yours or people trying, right? So if the only way you're gonna measure your success is by domination, you're probably gonna be unhappy. Like, you're just probably not going to work out for you, ever. Like, ever, because it's just almost impossible to be that. However, if you want to measure success by, like, thinking about what do I love to do? What do I want to do? And can I keep doing this for a long time? Because I like doing it, so you'd want to keep doing it for a long time. Then you start thinking about, like, well, what do I need to do to be in business for a long time? Well, I need to be profitable. So I can sustain the business. I can make more money than I spend. And like, for example, we've been in business for nearly 20 years. We don't dominate anything. I don't know, our market share is probably 0.whatever percent, like all things considered, but we have 100,000 people paying us every month. We generate tens of millions of dollars in profits annually. We have 54 people. We have a relatively small company, big profits, big influence. If I was measuring it on domination, I'd be upset. For 20 years, I'd be upset and unfulfilled and like frustrated. Or I could go, we've got it. We built a great business. We're profitable. We're able to do whatever we want to do. I can wake up and go to work and not feel like I'm under pressure against some goal that I can never achieve. And I can just run my business like I enjoy doing. So I think, you know, you've just got to stop and think about what's realistic. And hey, if we ended up dominating the market, that's a side effect of maybe doing a great job or doing something so novel that no one else has thought of it or whatever. But to go into something thinking you're going to dominate it or feeling like you must dominate it or you must change the world, again, air quotes around that, like, I just think you're setting yourself up for disappointment. You're setting an unrealistic milestone or goal, whatever word you want to use. I think you should just like go into business because you want to make something. You want to make something that you care about. And you want to get to profitability. And once you're there, then you can buy time. And this is a thing that people always want to buy more time. You actually can buy time. If you're a profitable company, you're essentially buying your own time. As long as you make a penny more than you spend and all your expenses are covered, you can stay in business forever. And then you have flexibility and freedom to change your business and do whatever you want to do versus always being in the red and struggling and hustling and never finally getting to that top rung or whatever, like you're just not gonna get there probably. So leave that alone. That's my feeling on it. And I also feel like there's a lot of hustling for hustling's sake.
Right.
A lot of busyness for busyness sake. I see people bragging about how busy they are. I don't get that. Like, I don't understand that at all. I don't think you should really be that busy. I think you should have a couple things to do that you're focused on. And you should also have lots of open time for opportunities and time to think and time to digest and time to decompress so you can do great work on the things you have to do versus like just bouncing from task to task to task to task to task. So I don't think that's a really effective way to do something over the long term. It might be fine like from 21 to 23, but at some point, like your career is quite long. People hopefully are employed for a long time. And you know, you may have to work up until your 60s. If you're only used to crushing it and hustling forever, like 10, 12, 14 hour days or whatever, or week, full weekends or whatever, like you can't sustain that. Your life's gonna change. You know, you're gonna maybe have a family at some point, or you're, even if you don't do that, like you're just gonna get older and you just can't hold up the energy anymore. So to set yourself up to only be able to work that way, I think is a really dangerous way to work.
Absolutely. I think that to the point that it's about the long-term view. You know, so many of these hustling businesses, it's about getting to the next thing, getting to the next thing. But where are you going to be 10 years from now, 20 years from now, 30 years from now? How are you going to sustain whatever it is that you're doing and make money doing it?
Yes.
And not kill yourself because you don't ever sleep?
Right. It will wear you down. Like, you are not superhuman. I don't care how great you think you are. And I know, I remember when I was 21, you always kind of, I can do anything. I'm 21 or whatever. Like, fine. But your youth is on your side, certainly. But youth goes away at a certain point, and like, your body, like, you're just a human being. You're an animal. Like, you have, you know, biological systems that will not let you work that hard forever without like really having some significant issues because of it. You have to sleep. You have to rest. You have to eat well. You have to do these things. And I always find it funny that that some people are you know, trying to hack food, like eating takes too much time.
Right.
It's like, what? It takes some time to eat, to like feed your body, to give your body nutrition. Like, it takes too much time. Like, what are you in such a rush for? What is it that you're doing that you can't even take a pause to eat your food? You know, like, what is that about? So anyway, I can go on and on about that, but I don't think that that is a healthy approach to work, and I don't think it's sustainable. And I think anyone who's doing that now will look back in 20 years and go, wow, I was manic back then. And gosh, I hope I've changed my habits by now, because if I haven't, I'm in real trouble.
All of that makes a lot of sense. As the book says, it doesn't have to be crazy at work. Plenty of good ideas in there to make it not so. And I want to thank you again for joining me today.
Thanks for having me. This was super fun.
Great.
Yeah, appreciate it.
We hope you enjoyed the episode.
How Success Happens comes out every week. To catch each episode, please subscribe to us on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. Like, share, and leave us a review so we can always be improving. Go to entrepreneur.com for more episodes of this show and our other great podcasts. Thanks for listening.